listener production.
Hi, this is Paul McIntyre. Welcome to the MI3 Audio Edition. I've been a business journalist for 25 years covering the marketing, media, agency and tech sectors. In this series, we talk to industry leaders about the global and local developments that you need to be across this week.
Well, if you're anything like me, it's somewhat bewildering out there on what is happening with viewers in the world of broadcaster TV services versus subscription streaming platforms versus online video in the social platforms. It's truly hectic. One of the biggest challenges today for broadcaster viewing across both free-to-air and digital services just did not exist 18 months ago. Namely, the global subscription streaming services all piling into ad-supported tiers, mainly because in their more mature markets, they've maxed out on tapping the wealthier under 40 bracket, which has driven much of their global growth. The likes of Netflix have discovered their ad-subsidized subscriptions help reduce customer churn in the current cost of living consumer environment. And Netflix actually makes more money out of ad tier subscribers than subscription-only customers. And what's interesting now is that while Netflix, Amazon Prime, and the rest have skewed younger in profile for subscribers, streaming services see a good chunk of their next round of growth coming from older segments, which remain the heartland of broadcast offers. TV broadcasters cop plenty of flack for their market challenges, but the streamers have their own very real audience, content, and customer revenue growth challenges too. It's looking a lot like Hunger Games. For brands and marketers really in the weeds on all the nuance in consumer media consumption, this conversation will be super helpful understanding how one of their biggest investment outlays, media and TV video advertising, is changing at a hell of a clip. So today's conversation is with an LA-based global TV and streaming analyst who, despite tracking the industry for millennia, says the disruption in TV and video in the past 12 to 18 months alone is unprecedented, particularly for the $350 billion TV and video advertising sector globally. Ampere Analysis Executive Director Guy Bisson was in Australia a few weeks ago for the Future of TV Advertising Forum, and he's one of the best placed to make sense of what is, without hyperbole, a world of pain for everyone. Fragmenting markets mean more complexity, cost, and conundrums for brands and advertisers trying to figure out where they will drive their best business results, and for the media sector, thick in a dogfight. So welcome, Guy. No pressure on you at all, but let's try to sort the wheat from the chaff on all this, shall we, and start with the big picture. How much ad spend is going into the TV market right now, and how do you carve it up, Guy? And welcome. Great to have you on the mics, and it's a very interesting and real conversation that's live, right, isn't it, in the market at the moment. Everyone's trying to work things out. So let's start with the big numbers of globally. How do you carve up this TV advertising market, the streaming market, the online social video market? It can be a little bit confusing for some.
Yes, absolutely. And thanks, Paul. There's certainly a lot of different definitions, a lot of different meanings associated with what marketeers tend to refer to in blanket terms as digital. From a television perspective, we're talking about advertising that is wrapped around some form of video and thus has viewers to monetize. So traditionally the big pot was television. So that's the traditional linear TV broadcast television channels that you watch. Over the last few years, so depending on the region, within the last 3 to 4 years, that has been overtaken by online video. And then we have a third segment that's a growing and increasingly important segment because of Netflix and Amazon and Disney, and that we refer to as video on demand plus FAST. FAST being free ad-supported streaming TV. It is a form of linear television that is streamed. So to put some numbers on that globally, online video, that social bit, is the biggest segment. It's $193 billion a year. Television, a little bit behind at $128 billion. Fast bit, where Netflix sits, where platforms like Tubi and Pluto and Freevee from Amazon sit, is at about $22 billion at the moment, but growing. To give some perspective on Australia, television is about 2.5 billion online, similar, about 2.5 billion in 2023, and that VOD segment still quite small at 0.4 billion.
We should clear up for our audience that may not be across the nuance of FAST channels. You've kind of explained it, but really what that is, it's a repurposed free-to-air or a linear feed that's actually coming through digital streams, right, through the digital properties of these broadcasters. That's essentially, and their genre, they tend to be genre-specific, right, Guy? We just have a quick overview so our audience understands that FAST bit.
Yeah, and it's important. I mean, it's actually probably the most talked about topic in the content business side of the industry at the moment, but it's actually still quite a small market. So specifically, it is streamed television, but it is streamed in a linear manner. So it's very like, for the end viewer, it's very like watching a scheduled TV channel. It tends to make use of catalog content and older content. And many of the channels that you will watch will be what we call single IP. That means they're based around a single show brand. So it might be something like CSI Channel or Midsummer Murders Channel or some popular long-running TV show that has now its own streamed FAST channel that is ad-supported. And it's a growing area of that ad-supported streaming segment alongside, as you mentioned at the top of the podcast, alongside Amazon, Netflix and others for the first time entering that ad-supported market.
Apart from those big numbers, and they are big numbers, and there is a shakeout coming, you're forecasting some big shifts there in market share between those three groups that we talked about, you know, traditional TV, video on demand, subscription stuff, and social video. What do you see happening there, Guy? There's some big shifts in the next couple of years, I think.
Yeah, so I think we're all well aware from our own habits and those of our peers that streaming, of course, is the big growth area still. And if we apply that to what's happening with the money around advertising spend, and again, thinking of global figures. So where we said TV today was $128 billion, in 6 years' time, it will be pretty much the same, $132. So small amount of growth, but definitely not significant, broadly flat. By contrast, that online video segment, which is our social segment, is going to grow from that $193 to $280 billion. So about 30%+ growth for that social segment. And VOD and FAST, so this is where Netflix, Amazon sit, is going from that $22 to about $45. So slightly more than doubling. And what I can say is that is almost certainly for that segment an underestimate, because the nature of forecasting is that we don't know what we don't know. And by that, I mean there will be launches that we haven't even considered or thought about yet during that six-year period, because it's such a fast-moving area and growth area that will happen and thus add to the momentum of that sector in particular. So I think doubling is an underestimate there.
On your current forecast, though, Guy, that sort of equates to, I think you say, about an 18 share point change for television versus the video on demand subscription and FAST services and social video. Is that right? There's an 18 point decline in share there.
Yeah. So if we think about the whole market for streamed video advertising, including the broadcasters, and the whole market is growing. But obviously, increasingly, some of that market share is growing, is going to the likes of Netflix and Amazon and others. So if we were to think they did not, they were not in the ad market, which let's remember they weren't 12 months ago, we could assume that share would go to the broadcasters. And so if we take one away from the other, we end up with about an 18% share of the money that is going to those streamers that would conceivably have gone to the broadcasters. And again, that's probably an underestimate.
In terms of audience numbers, so we've talked about the revenue alignment for those three core categories in television and video. Audience-wise, what are some of the metrics you can talk around there for what's been happening?
Yeah, so we survey viewers and audiences a couple of times a year, and we've been doing that since 2015. And so we do have some
in a number of markets, right? How many markets are you doing that in, Guy?
We're doing that in 29 markets across all of the regions, so Asia, Europe, the US, Latin America, and the Middle East. And we can see consistent trends. And of course, that consistent trend is the decline of linear television and the rise of streaming television. Now, the figures are self-reported, so they don't quite align with the audience measurement body's figures. Interestingly, they broadly align in terms of total daily viewing time. So depending on market, that's somewhere between 4 and 5 hours a day that people spend watching television in some format.
Sorry, I just want to be clear that yep. in some TV format, that includes social video as well, right? Short form.
That does. It includes all streamed content and some online social video. But the bulk of it is made up of actually made up of long form type television. So if we then start to break those figures down across those 29 markets, on average, linear television and streamed television, so broadcast channels, the likes of Netflix, are now roughly equal, so 1 hour each a day. By contrast, social video is about 40 minutes a day. Streaming from the broadcasters, which you could reasonably add back into their linear number of an hour, is another 31 minutes. And then we've got ad-supported streaming, which is that emerging market, the FAST channels and the likes of Pluto, Tubi, Freevee, that comes from Amazon, is only about 8 minutes at the moment.
The interesting thing there, of course, is some of the broadcasters are getting into FAST channels as well. So there's a bit of you could bundle up a few bits and pieces here and they could bolster their numbers. But how are those numbers? And they are 2023 numbers, I think, Guy. How are they? What's the trend line there?
Yeah,
what does it say?
Right.
If you go back 5 years in your data, what's changed?
We can see back in 2017 that linear TV was double what it is today. Whereas SVOD, streaming from Netflix and others, was half what it is today. So
right.
One's doubled and one's halved during that relatively short period. Of course, everyone had a boost during the pandemic, during the lockdown, but streaming had a particular boost during that period.
And what are some of the, have you got Australian numbers there, Guy, in terms of the time spent to those different video and television channels?
Yeah, and they're broadly similar, to be honest, to the global trends. The big difference is that people here report that they watch more streamed content, more SVOD, as we call it, from Netflix and others, than they do of the linear TV. So that inflection point, where globally they're roughly equal at the moment, has already happened in Australia, and people spend more time each day, so they say, watching Netflix and other platforms than they are watching the linear channels. The social number is the same. It's 40 minutes. The ad-supported streaming is the same at 8 minutes. But that's SVOD versus TV number is where the difference in Australia is. And that's why it's such an interesting market, that outside this market, the money already followed. Whereas here, the money is staying with the broadcasters and the linear channels, and is much more resistant to the shift that we're seeing elsewhere.
But to be clear on that, when you say the money moved faster in international markets outside of Australia, the ad-supported tiers for the streaming players like Netflix, they've only been in the market a year. So are you saying that elsewhere globally, the money's moved faster than what it has in this last year than Australia?
Yeah, so what I'm saying is globally that, and it's, if we put to one side for a moment the Netflixes and the Amazons who are new to the market, the money shifting to that online video, which is largely social, and within that, largely Google and Facebook, has been much quicker than it has been here. So we saw an inflection point where that number overtook television, again, depending on region, 3, 4, 5 years ago. Whereas here, we're only just reaching that point.
Let's get to the ructions right now and the focus in those first two categories as streamers move into what was TV's territory, Guy. So this is the interesting bit from your view, though. Both broadcasters and streamers, in your view, have their own challenges. So why don't we, because we're good at giving broadcasters a kick, why don't we start first with the streamers? They do have some issues, which is why some of the market moves we're seeing now are happening, right? So just talk us through what the big challenge for the SVOD services, the Netflix, the Amazons, the Disney Pluses and so forth.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, because I think if you drill into it, everyone has known that streaming is growing very, very quickly in pretty much all markets. Traditional broadcasters, traditional pay television has recognized and to some degree understood that threat for a decade. And suddenly this year, everything's changed again. And what's changed is that those streamers no longer have it all their own way. So they are facing significant challenges to their businesses. And those challenges are multiple, just as the challenges for broadcasters are multiple, but they're coming from different sectors. So think of those streamers. Yes, they've moved into advertising, but their main business is subscription still. That subscription revenue is under threat because they are finding it harder and harder to capture a new customer, especially in the wealthy markets. They're effectively saturated. There are no new customers to find. At the same time, they had this absolute boom during the COVID lockdowns, and it really did. It boosted everyone. It boosted TV viewing across the board, but it particularly boosted the streamers. And they came out of lockdown, and suddenly a situation which they referred to as carry forward ended. And carry forward meant growth that they would have expected 1 or 2 years into the future got pulled back into the lockdown period. So that boom suddenly ended, and there was no more growth coming in. And what that's done is put their revenue under pressure, and they have reacted relatively quickly in terms of rationalizing spend on content. So not that they're not spending on content, not that they're even reducing spend in content, but they are reducing the rate at which they grow investment in content very, very substantially. That's particularly true of the studios, the Hollywood studios, who, of course, moved into streaming right before the pandemic. If you think back to Disney Plus, which was the first, really, of the big studios to go feet first into streaming, they launched just before lockdown, which was kind of good and bad. Good in that they got that boost from the lockdown. So
there was a bit of a hangover afterwards. There was a bit of a wake-up call afterwards, right?
Exactly. So they're rationalizing content spend, they're rationalizing staffing costs. And of course, the world itself is in something of a turmoil, both with still cost of living crisis in many regions, political turmoil, of course, the likes of which we haven't seen for some decades. And all of that has an impact on their business. And so as a result, they're pulling back, they're changing their content strategy. Conversely, they're moving, therefore, into some of the lower cost content that traditionally has been the bread and butter of broadcast television. So we saw during the pandemic that they suddenly jumped into reality TV, game shows, light entertainment, because scripted content, dramas, could not get made during the pandemic. All the actors, like everyone else, were in lockdown. They couldn't meet up and film shows. So they moved into unscripted, which is a bit easier to make in that situation. And they've stayed because it's great for localizing. It's great for formatting, as we call it, making local versions of a specific show. It's cheap to make, and it engages a big segment of the audience. So a lot of change going on in that sector.
I just want to clarify something you said a little bit earlier, Guy, when you said that the SVOD services, the streaming services, had no new customers to find. That was sort of, it's a particular customer segment, right, that they've been chasing, and it's that where it's run out. We'll get you to talk, it's the under sort of 40s, I guess, under 40-year-olds. But also, it was also punctuated by the fact that when you say no new customers to find, Netflix had a couple of earnings, couple of quarters of earnings results where they didn't get the growth, and that was the sort of the catalyst for them, I think you say, going into these ad tiers. So just contextualize that no new customers, Guy.
Yeah, and of course, when I say no new customers, I'm referring really to the heavily saturated markets. There are new customers in regions like Asia, in regions like sub-Saharan Africa, that still plenty of headroom for growth there. There's also opportunity with some of the older demographics who are not saturated yet in that streaming market. But you're absolutely right. Netflix had always said that they would say till they were blue in the face, they will not launch advertising. And most analysts believed that and thought the same, that they were fulfilling a premium channel slot within the market. And then they had a couple of quarters post-pandemic where they went backwards. So their customer base reduced rather than grew. It was largely driven by the US market. But nonetheless, it was a big, big shock. And literally within weeks, the announcement came that they were launching an ad tier completely out of the blue. It took many people by shock. But nonetheless, that's where they've gone. And since then, all of the streaming platforms, global streaming platforms, bar Apple, has moved into advertising as well.
So there's the challenge, some of the challenges that the streamers have faced and are facing. What about the broadcasters, the pain points for broadcasters? There's a whole bunch of new pain points that, as you've already said, they didn't even have a year ago. What are the biggest ones for them, Guy, in your view?
Well, twofold, really, if we think of two big issues. One is the audience migration to streaming, and that in itself is twofold. It's one, simply audiences watching elsewhere, rather than on the broadcast channels. And it's also that the younger audience in particular are migrating away from both the linear feeds of those broadcast channels and their streaming platforms. So audience migration is the big one. And of course, renewed or new competition for advertising dollars. So just losing audience, obviously, is a threat to advertising. But when you get a whole load of new entrants into the market, which differ from social video, which has been the main threat to date, because they program premium long-form content. There are many in the television industry who would argue that Google, YouTube, Facebook, that sort of video is in no way comparable to long-form television, which you can take either side of the argument. The fact is, it's taking viewers, but it is a different viewing experience, tends to be viewed on different devices from the main screen in the household. The big difference now is that these streamers, the Netflixes and Amazons of this world, have really good, high-quality, long-form programming that people tend to watch on their main big screen in the sitting room. And so in that respect, it really is much closer to the broadcast viewing experience than perhaps social video. And the potential for it to begin to take market share, especially as it attracts a younger, wealthier audience, is quite significant.
And so I guess this is where, you know, you make a really good point in the last 12 to 18 months, where the battle in digital was between sort of the broadcaster long form and short form social. And it was quite a fair split in the sort of the formats that were on offer. Now you've got lots of, you know, streaming television networks coming into the broadcaster's sort of heartland territory. And that's where I think you even say most of the market globally 12, 18 months ago did not see this, wasn't on their radar for strategic planning, competition, et cetera. It was speculated perhaps, but never wasn't live and real. Now it's live and real, and already that impact is starting to bite.
Yeah, I think we're still obviously very early days for the entrance of these platforms into the advertising market. And the additional option that they bring is an ability to target. So if you think of the streaming platforms, and we've just positioned them as having similar content to real television, let's call it in inverted commas, long form content, and they have a large audience. So without targeting, they can still do that broad, large audience, non-targeted ads for brand building that the broadcasters can do. But additionally, they can very finely target advertising to their viewer base, because the platforms which you pay for obviously know who you are. You log in as soon as you flick to the platform on your television set, and they know exactly what you're watching. They know what you like, what you don't like, And in cases like Amazon, they also know what you've been searching for to buy. So there's a lot of additional potential.
Well, and what you buy.
And what you buy. Although, yes, I question that sometimes, having been targeted myself. But certainly they've got this sort of double-pronged ability to do what TV does well, which is brand safe advertising across a large audience. That's not really about targeting. It's about, you know, brand building for the product. And then they can also do quite specific targeting.
Just on the Amazon one, because the conversation in the Australian market is that Amazon is about to launch, at least with their ad tier offer, and that there is this magic sort of flywheel of connecting exposure and advertising context to a purchase at a store level, or in Amazon's case, e-com. So there's a lot of sort of expectation that Amazon will absolutely romp this in the Australian market. They have probably an estimated 3 to 4 million subscribers on their Prime service, their entertainment platform. So do you see that that threat is being overplayed in the Australian market versus what you've seen in the US and your personal experience in being targeted? Clearly, you've gone and bought cat food at Amazon Guy and you've been offered a Ferrari or something.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's what I was about to say. Amazon don't sell new cars. So if you're selling a car, you're probably not going to want to be targeting on Amazon. But if you're selling car cleaning products, then potentially Amazon is a very strong bet there. It's really difficult to say, honestly, at the moment, both how prevalent that very precise targeting is and how effective it is for advertisers. We don't have the data at the moment. We're working on that. But at the moment, we can really only make assumptions about how effective that will be. And as I said, I think while that's extremely interesting, the ability to very precisely target and, as you say, link it through to an actual purchase, the real threat is that two-pronged approach that they can bring to the market, because online social video has grown strongly because you can track the viewer from the click through the advert to some sort of behavior, which is great, and Netflix and Amazon and others will be able to do that. But it's also that broader reach that they can bring that is the potentially the bigger threat to advertising, because it's no longer about should I do TV or should I do online. It's I can do everything I can do on TV, on streaming, with traceability, with a relation to the audience and to a purchase. So it's a really interesting dynamic at the moment, and that's why everything has shifted just in this last 8 to 12 months.
We should say there, by the way, when we talk about that targeting capability of the SVOD players that have got ad tiers, obviously the broadcasters own broadcast video on demand. Their own platforms can do that targeting as well. They've got logged in users, so they can compete on that at that level at least, that top line targeting and profile stuff with logged in users.
Yes, they can, but that's why it's so important that they get that strategy around their streaming assets right, because the data shows that they are still losing that young audience on those platforms, whereas Netflix and Amazon are mopping up those younger, wealthier audiences. Of course, we don't mean the entire young audience has deserted broadcast, absolutely not. But they're starting to skew away from that audience. And that's why a digital first strategy for the broadcasters, who to some degree have rested on their laurels in this market because television spend has not shifted to the degree it has elsewhere. That's why it becomes so important now with the entrance of these players to get the strategy right.
Just on that, so you're definitely seeing then that even in the US and other markets, all broadcasters, all traditional broadcasters with digital services, digital content platforms are not making up that migration gap between people leaving linear, what we'd call free-to-air here, but in the US obviously delivered a lot through cable television, but they're not swapping out the broadcaster linear feeds for their VOD offers. It's going elsewhere in other markets as well as Australia. Yeah, same everywhere.
Pretty much the same everywhere. I think the only possible exception that we've come across is the BBC in the UK, who are managing to capture the young audience as well. But that's partly a statistical effect, because they are so heavily watched in the country that it thus trends to average, whereas streaming services of broadcasters are not really as heavily watched as the BBC iPlayer is in the UK. But yes, other than that exception, we're pretty much seeing this for every broadcast channel. And that's why it's really interesting, because you could argue that if you give young people access to the content in the way they want to engage, namely streamed, then they should continue to watch on the stream platform. The fact that they are starting to skew away from the broadcast, it's something other than the mode of delivery. It's not about linear versus streaming. And thus, the only place left to look is the content that's being delivered. And why is that not attracting them to the streaming services?
You also, Guy, make a point that with this sort of conversation we're having, to sort of assume that, the decades-old predictions of television is dead, well, television as we know, it's, reinvented itself, but broadcast television or linear television is not yet dead either. You still argue that, and most should believe, I think you say, that it's still a very powerful medium for advertisers, both in a linear and broadcast context. So it's not the elimination of this, it's the fact that they're getting reprioritized.
Yeah, and it's a really important point, to the point that I used to start any talk I gave with a disclaimer. Because we're analyzing the future, and because there's so much going on in streaming, that's what we tend to talk about. And thus, it's too easy to give the impression that linear TV and broadcast TV is now worthless, nothing. But that, of course, is not the case. Households are still watching linear broadcast TV. In this country, even slightly more than streaming, on a daily basis. That's where they're going for a lot of their content and a lot of their programming. So still a really important medium. And there are still many types of content that, of course, only really work when they're delivered live, for which linear TV is very effective. So it's an important point to make that is still a very significant market, but it is changing and it is under threat. And if you're in business, you're seeking the strongest grace you can get for your shareholders, investors, and that thus needs to address where the market is heading.
So let's get to then, what do you think broadcasters do? You mentioned content just before, but what do broadcasters do, Guy, and what are the streamers planning? Because they have also got their eye on some of the other bits of broadcast heartland, right? Whether that be, you said, unscripted, but also sports rights and the core audience that probably broadcasters get sort of punished for, which is skewing older, which is you and I, by the way. Well, at least me anyway. But that now could be a new territory for some serious competition and being chased by those younger streaming platforms, ironically.
Yeah, because of saturation among the young audience, the streamers, again, in terms of their content strategy, are looking to the over 54s. And so the content that they're making, the content they're commissioning, is increasingly designed to appeal to that age group. The influx of crime drama and crime procedurals, real life crime that you'll have noticed on streaming platforms, the increase in documentary, particularly biographical documentary, but also documentary centered around sport. All of that is about trying to engage, attract, and retain a slightly older audience. Whereas conversely, actually, some of that reality TV that they've started making is to keep that younger audience happy as well. And then their core drama that we think of them of, the Stranger Things and the fantasy stuff, is still there also for the younger people. So they're very strong in those areas. They're increasingly encroaching on the footprint of broadcasters, both with unscripted and with stuff for older people. And content strategy thus becomes absolutely key to success.
And they're moving, at least in the US, there's been some interesting developments, hasn't there, on sports rights, to the point where even where we saw, I think it's probably 2 or 3 weeks ago, it could be longer now, it could be more than a month actually, where we saw, this has got to be a signal. I'm interested in your thoughts, Guy. I mean, if you've got Fox and Disney-owned ESPN and part of Warner Brothers Discovery combining together to create a sporting platform for viewers and they're combining it, that's surely a signal to say we have to align and collaborate to compete rather than go it alone individually. Or am I reading too much into that?
No, you're not. I mean, obviously sports, there's many different approaches to sport. There is a streamer called DAZN that is focused entirely on sport and is trying to become the Netflix of sport, as some people call it, buying up rights, some rights globally for lower cost sport, but also crucially buying some of that really premium sport, the top league soccer in some of the European countries, for example, that would traditionally would have gone to the pay TV broadcasters. Those partners that you talk of in the US, of course, are already the main buyers of sport. So Disney owns ESPN, a big sport channel, Fox owns Fox Sports, etc. So I think they've seen the writing on the wall in terms of where people want to engage with the content. And they can see the cost of sports rights, which was inflating for many, many years, actually has started to slow that inflation, but not in the US. And they can see the power of collaborating to create a single platform for that really premium content. That deal, of course, currently under investigation by competition authorities. So we will see if that is allowed for those already quite dominant players to collaborate on a streaming platform. But then elsewhere, we've got the likes of Amazon, who've bought piecemeal some premium rights. Interestingly, the Premier League, which is the top soccer in the UK, they had and they've backed out of for the next round. So it obviously didn't work that well for them. But in the US, they've got some NFL rights. And Apple, of course, has baseball, some of the baseball rights, which again is big in the US. But I think Apple is an interesting example in that they've also gone ahead and not just piecemeal bought some key premium rights, but bought global rights to some sports. So MLS, which is the US soccer league, popular perhaps in the US, but I don't think anyone outside the US actually watches it. And they've bought the global rights to that. And the opportunity there, of course, is to take something low cost that doesn't have an audience outside its home market, and using your global platform, build it into something big and thus create value for both partners. And that's a really interesting aspect of streaming, because there were no global platforms before streamers came along. The whole television business, whether it was the free TV with ads or the pay TV with subscription, was geographically segmented. All of the business aspects of it, from the purchase of sports to the rights to movies and the making of TV shows, was completely geographically segmented. And now you've got these global platforms, and it introduces all sorts of interesting opportunity to utilize that platform to build new sport properties.
Collaboration, alliance, JV, joint venture that we talked earlier in the sports area in the US, Fox Sports, ESPN, and some of the Warner Brothers Discovery assets. I'm not sure what they are. You might be able to highlight that. But does that, I mean, the fact that you've got such massive giants in a massive market like the US getting together, is that not a signal, or is that a signal for other markets with broadcasters full stop, that there needs to be more alliance and they need to play even stronger together to compete with the global platforms that are coming at them? Is there a cue there for something?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question, because, of course, there are two sides to it. There's the business side of, can we collaborate, should we collaborate in order to pool our resources and thus fend off the global threat. But there's the other aspect, which is the audience aspect. And what we've seen throughout time, and well before streaming, there were periods in history where a second buyer or a third buyer came into a market to the sports rights. Of course, for the viewer, that's not a great thing, because instead of having one place where you watched, which tended to be the dominant pay TV platform in the market, suddenly you had two or three. And what we're seeing with the streamers' entrance is exactly that again, that the rights are fragmenting across multiple platforms. So if you want to watch everything, you now have to buy into multiple platforms. So there are two positives to business combination pooling of resources. One is, yes, local players can compete more effectively with some of these global players who have deep pockets. And the second is, it's a positive for the viewer base in terms of, again, being able to go to one place to get all of the sport they want.
So that's the sports rights guy, but quickly run us through some interesting observations that your research is bringing up on genres and what's skewing to platforms and to broadcast. And let's go with what opportunities it throws up for broadcasters. I think you're very strong on the fact that a lot of these formats, a lot of this content has to be digital first. So we might cover that as well.
Yeah, so there are certain genres that young people really engage with, just as there are genres like, as we were talking about, crime and crime procedurals and true crime that older people engage with. What we've seen consistently in the data is that the genres that young people is number one, comedy, very strong. Obviously, content aimed at children and families, young families, is strong for those younger households. And then we've got content like romance, romantic drama, that are also strong for younger age groups. So the streamers are, if you look at their budget allocation in terms of where they're spending money, that's where a lot of the focus is. Whereas the broadcasters, of course, have other requirements. So they're spending a lot more on other areas. Actually, they spend a lot more on that entertainment segment because a lot of their content is still in that unscripted entertainment space. And then they have other commitments around news and current affairs programming that the streamers don't really have to worry about. Interesting mix of content spend and opportunity to focus in on some of those genres. But even if one doesn't focus in on spend, you can focus in terms of prominence. So one of the things I argue is that look at what the streamers do well, shamelessly copy what they do well. And if you can't copy literally because you haven't got the budget, you haven't got the volume of content, at least you can copy from a perception perspective. And the way that you bring content forward on streaming platforms for different audiences can lift certain segments up, even if they're not that big for you, to address the audience behavior and the audience demand and interest in different types of content.
Well, the argument here in the Australian market is something like Love Island, which is a digitally streamed reality show that is working very well for Nine, but it is really targeting a certain segment. More of that is what you're sort of suggesting happens from the broadcaster camp, if they are going to, if not regain those lost young viewers, sort of slow the exodus from their portfolio. Is that part of the plan there?
Yeah, so there's exactly, content like Love Island is very, very powerful for that demographic. And it's how you prioritize on the streaming platform. So digital first strategies that, of course, highlight that type of content, bring it to the forefront for that younger audience. It's also extremely good for longer term engagement because these series tend to run over many, many weeks. Whereas typically now for drama, the audience is used to a box set dropping on day one. Because we're in a saturated market, and because the broadcasters also are challenged from an audience perspective, that engagement over a longer term is really, really important. And things like Love Island are great for that. So we're not saying in any way that one should ignore drama or high budget content and just focus in on reality TV and Love Island type shows. But it's about how you position that, how you use it to premiere on the streaming platform, how you engage with ancillary content around those key shows for the younger audience on the streaming platform, without ignoring the power, of course, of those higher budget dramas. In the UK, it tends to be Sunday night dramas, because the BBC will drop their new big budget drama on a Sunday night, and so will ITV.
We'll wrap this up with some key takeouts from you. What is your hunch then on how all this plays out in a few years? Basically, top line is broadcasters have peaked, streamers maybe have peaked if they can't get an older audience in and as subscribers. And how does it all wash out in the next couple of years? And what sort of advice do you have?
Let's go right up into the sky and take a really wide angle view. And one of the things that I'm saying is that all of these weird things that we've been talking about, SVOD, AVOD, BVOD, all sorts of different VODs, FAST, I think we're going to start moving away from that, because at the end of the day, all the viewer cares about at home is, do I have to pay for it or not? And we used to have a very simple way to delineate television along the lines of, do I have to pay or not? And we used the terms pay television and free television. And I think we're probably moving back in that direction. Most television, of course, will be streamed. And so that brings us back to, where will the dominant players be in those two pots, pay and free? It's very clear that the global streamers are very, very strong in that pay TV space, increasingly important in the free TV space. But let's not forget that the parent companies of those streamers, and I'm not talking now about Netflix and Amazon, but about Disney and Warner and Paramount and all the studios that have now their streaming platforms, were always in the pay and free TV market. So we're seeing a shift of their business from one form of distribution to another. To date, they've mainly focused on that subscription business. Now they're coming back to advertising, but they were always there, and they always had free-to-air channels. They own the networks in the US. They have lots of cable TV channels. So we're kind of seeing both a convergence, but also a return to form within this market that has been just wildly shifting from a broadcast medium to a streaming medium. And I think that will be an ongoing trend. But then, of course, we've got the new entrants like Apple and Netflix and Amazon, who will begin and continue to take market share from that sector. But broadly, we will go back to conceptually thinking of pay TV and free TV. A lot of the same players will be in it. The broadcasters are not going to die. Their strategies need to evolve, absolutely. But they can continue to gain a significant share of particularly the free-to-air market, where they've traditionally been strong, as long as they continue to think about what the audience demands and what sort of content is going to bring them onto streaming, and as long as they start to think of those streaming platforms as a primary form of delivery, not a secondary form of delivery.
The difference being, this time around, in this repeating world of pay and free TV, which is a great way to sort of reframe everything that we've seen since probably the 90s, which was pay TV and satellite boxes and whatever else. But the key point here is that the broadcasters won't, this time around, own or define the category of television, will they? They will have to share it. I guess that's the sort of the big difference from what we might have seen 10 years ago.
Yes, they have to share it. And that, as we were saying earlier, they're sharing it with a completely new concept of television, which is global television. Before, as I was saying, both the business, but also a lot of the content that was most successful was local content, because that's how the market worked. That's what the audience wanted. Increasingly, they're not only watching other content in their own language, but they're engaging with global content that's been made in Latin America and Asia and other places and is in a completely different language. So the global nature of the streamers has really changed many, many aspects of the market, the business, but also the audience expectation. And that's obviously had an impact on the local players.
One final question in there, Guy, which is you've been in the Australian market. How would you gauge the sentiment? What's your sense on where the television and streaming market is, where the incumbent players, how are they feeling? How would you encapsulate what's happening with it in Australia at the moment? You've been here, you know, annually, lots.
Yeah, so I think as we were touching on at the beginning, everyone has been fully aware that there's a massive change going on, that there is increasing power going to these global streamers, and they've known that for a decade. And we've kind of been on a trajectory where we know this is going on, we understand what's going on, and we can kind of deal with it. And I think the sentiment at the moment is what on earth just happened, kind of, because of this big shift in strategy, this big shift in terms of content, in terms of advertising, in terms of where the spend and strategy priorities are. And we're kind of back to square one, that everything's changed again. And what we thought we understood, which was challenging for the last 10 years, has just shifted again. And so we start the whole cycle again. But that's the nature of business. And it's certainly the nature of the entertainment business, that it both goes in cycles, but it also has these periods of intense change for several years before we kind of get back to kind of understanding what's going on. And then something else will change.
And this time around, though, the luxury for time to pontificate is probably not there as what it was a couple of years ago. So that intense cycle you talk about and the change that's coming at the industry, they actually have to move pretty quickly this time. There's not a lot of what if, it's got to move or they will lose. Like every day is another bunch of lost eyeballs potentially.
Yeah, there's an old forecaster's adage, which is that we always overestimate the short term and underestimate the long term. So I would caution that, yes, we're in a period of intense change again, but it's very easy to overestimate that short term and then underestimate the longer term. So it's about positioning for that slightly longer, medium and long term change that is coming on. There's still time, and understanding it is key, but don't miss the boat.
Really, really instructive, good perspective on what's happening globally and locally. Guy Bisson, thanks for joining, and look forward to your data feed in another 6 to 12 months. Thanks for joining.
Thank you.
This MI3 Audio Edition was presented by Paul McIntyre. That's moi. Producer, Nick Slater. Music by Matt Dwyer. For more episodes, go to listener.com or download the Listener app and search MI3 Audio Edition to listen for free. Listener.